I've got a few things sort of in detail prepared to say. I thought what I would do in this last lecture was also try and give at least a bit of a personal perspective on sort of where some of the interesting topics are that in which you would use theoretical gravity at the moment. So in other words, sort of beyond Einstein gravity, because there's sort of one of the interesting formal arenas of research is actually trying to look at generalizations of general relativity, in other words, going beyond Einstein gravity. So just to start off, just thought I'd just ask a couple of questions of ourselves, and that is, how much or how do we know how much we can trust general relativity? So by Einstein gravity, I'm meaning really four-dimensional standard Einstein-Hilbert action. So RAB minus a half R GAB is equal to 8 pi G TAB. So the standard, absolutely standard Einstein equations. So the things that we know about gravity, or how can we check it? So you've already heard about solar system tests, so such as light bending, perihelion precession, on and so forth. So any theory of gravity has got to look right on the solar system scale. There's also consistency from cosmology. If you've got a theory of gravity, you're going to have to apply it to the universe. So you better be able to reproduce the standard results. So nucleosynthesis, the microwave background, cosmological expansion, etc. But how much do we trust general relativity at these sort of cosmological scales? So for those of you that have been doing the cosmology course, you'll know that standard cosmology needs a couple of extra ingredients over our normal Einstein relativity and normal sort of standard model matter. We also need dark matter. So we need that. The simplest evidence that we need it is coming from galactic rotation curves. But we also need it to get structure formation right. So in other words, to make our cosmological model work, we always have to put in some component of dark matter. And then that was known quite early on. But then we also need dark energy. And so this is essentially this is a lambda-like term, where we have an energy content to the universe which has a negative pressure. So it's a cosmological constant type source, and the evidence for this is, well, mostly with the supernova data, but it's also, again, consistency together with all the other cosmological observations. So it's also CMB telling us that we've got a flat universe. So a low Einstein gravity gives us sensible cosmology. We get the Friedman-Robertson-Walker solutions out of some very minimal assumptions. Nonetheless, the standard cosmological model needs ingredients that we don't necessarily directly have coming from particle physics. So you may have seen this sort of like a pie chart where, I'll never get it exactly right, but approximately speaking, we get some colors. You guys have swiped the colors next door for your tutorial room. There's this beautiful box of colored chalk here. So this is our dark energy. The dark energy is the bulk of the universe, about 3/4 of the universe. The dark matter is around about sort of 23-ish percent. And then this is our known matter. Which is a tiny component of the universe. So basically, most of the universe, we don't really know what it is, theoretically. So somebody's jokingly called that the pizza that nobody ordered. So that's basically our universe. So then other tests of gravity. So we've already, I mean, even with my second bullet point, we've got something where, although Einstein gravity is okay, we have to add extra ingredients. We've also got things like tests coming from, you know, binary pulsar data, the fact that we know that if you have two objects orbiting each other, they should emit gravitational radiation, according to general relativity, which will make them slow down. So again, that data's looks good for general relativity. And then we've got like lab scale or small scale tests. So the upshot is that something like Einstein gravity, an inverse square law for gravity, we believe works pretty well sort of at roughly from the submillimeter scale. So if I want to be conservative, I'll say that we kind of are fairly confident for Einstein gravity from somewhere below the millimeter scale up to a kiloparsec type of scale. And indeed, if you felt that the evidence for dark matter was very good, or as soon as we have a direct detection of dark matter, we'll probably push this up to the sort of, well, even beyond that, I would say, well above the galactic scale. So we do have very good reasons to believe in Einstein gravity. But then we also, yes, well, from the galactic scale. So I was just sort of trying to sort of go up to something aboard a galactic scale, sort of saying. I think that's what I mean there. I mean, personally, I don't have a problem with dark matter, but nonetheless, you know. Okay, so that's sort of essentially, if we're going to come up with alternatives or go beyond Einstein gravity, we have to always come back to this reference page and make sure that whatever we've come up with is consistent along a wide range of scales and also is consistent over a long range in time. That's essentially what cosmology is telling us. So the first thing I want to say something about is extra dimensions, because I've talked an awful lot about gravity in general, and in particular, gravity in more than four dimensions. And so the motivating feature behind that is that string theorists tell us that we live in more than four dimensions. So do these extra dimensions cause us problems? So that's the question. Can we have extra dimensions without them being problematic? So we have to make sure that we have normal, you know, Einstein Newtonian type gravity on our normal everyday scales. But we also have to make sure that we have consistency with cosmology. So one of the problems with extra dimensions is that typically, however we choose to hide our extra dimensions, we often have light degrees of freedom. So this is called the moduli problem. So if we look at this in the context of the Kaluza-Klein model, when we did the very simple Kaluza-Klein theory, we found that if we reduced five-dimensional gravity to four dimensions, we had three fields. We had our normal metric, normal four-dimensional geometry. We had something that looked like a gauge field, which we didn't mind because we do have a gauge field present. But we also had this scalar field, and it was a scalar field living in the gravitational sector. So this scalar field here, which was dependent, a sort of breather mode, a size, that's problematic because we really don't have a scalar gravitational force. We don't see any evidence for it in the solar system or in cosmology. That was the reason why Kaluza-Klein theory sort of remained as a theoretical oddity for many years. So cosmologically, if we look at Kaluza-Klein gravity and couple it to ordinary matter, we find that as as in a cosmological setting where you have time dependence, typically this internal dimension will either contract and become singular, or it will expand and space will essentially decompactify. So cosmologically, phi evolves too much, if you like. So, so usually, we need to have a means of stabilizing our internal dimensions. So that's one of the the problems or challenges is, if we have extra dimensions, how do we hide them? And once we've hidden them, how do we make sure they don't leave any detectable traces in the universe as we know it now? So that's a Kaluza-Klein theory. One of the things I wanted to discuss in some detail is some ideas about extra dimensions, which seen quite a lot of activity in the past few years. So this sort of topic that I just want to try and give you a flavor of is known as large extra dimensions. So normally, because of the problems of Kaluza-Klein theory, it was kind of assumed that extra dimensions would be wrapped up on a very small scale, somehow stabilized, and to some extent, the problem was kind of swept under the carpet. So large extra dimensions is actually an interesting alternative. So first of all, I want to just recall something that I did mention when we did Kaluza-Klein theory, but it probably didn't really seem particularly relevant, or perhaps it wasn't obvious what I was driving at. So in Kaluza-Klein theory, you're taking a five-dimensional gravitational action, and you're integrating out over some internal direction to get something that looks like a four-dimensional Einstein action. And in the process of that integration, you got this length of the internal dimension. And so I mentioned that what this meant was, in four dimensions, so I'll either denote the four-dimensional Newton's constant by either G4 or Gn. That the four-dimensional Newton's constant was dependent on the higher-dimensional Newton's constant plus a scale of the internal dimension. And so I could rewrite that as a relation between the Planck masses, just the same sort of expression. And so it's saying that our four-dimensional Planck mass, which of course we know is this rather large number, is actually a derived quantity. And so in general, if I think of my internal manifold as having a sort of typical length scale associated with it, if I do a Kaluza-Klein type of reduction, then I would get a relation between the higher dimensional Planck mass and the lower dimensional Planck mass, which depended on the scale of the internal manifold. So I can also write this as the higher dimensional Planck mass, let's just get my factors right, to the so I'm now writing n as my number of extra dimensions. So normally, if you imagine that your length scale was at the Planck scale, which is what people used to do if thinking about a Kaluza-Klein compactification, then if you think about this relation in Planck units, it's like saying, well, all you know, the higher dimensional Planck mass is the same scale as the lower dimensional Planck mass is the same scale as the internal manifold. But now suppose you let the internal manifold be a bit bigger, then that enables you to sort of generate a hierarchy of scale between these two different mass scales. And so this is, in essence, the idea behind large extra dimensions. There's the fact that the Planck scale is so much different to the sort of standard model scale. There's a large number of orders of magnitude in between the two. And it's kind of hard to explain why that is, or at least to sort of make that a stable situation. And so maybe the reason the Planck scale is as high as it is something which simply comes down to some sort of geometrical accident almost. So if we kind of actually put some numbers down here, so I have to remind myself what they are. So let's kind of look at what length scales we would need to have. So if we had one of these Kaluza-Klein type of length scales, so if I rewrite that last relation and solve for the internal scale, L, to sort of say, well, how many Planck scales is it? I look at what this is. Then, to put it in more or less everyday units, simply all I've done here is kind of rewritten, sort of pulled out all the various factors of 10 and rewritten my Planck scale in terms of more everyday units. And so if we wanted to lower our fundamental gravity scale, the higher dimensional Planck mass or Planck scale is what is telling us about the fundamental scale of gravity, not what we see in four dimensions. So if we wanted to have a fundamental gravity scale, say of order 10 TV, just picking a number out of a hat at random, then we could could somehow pick one, a length. We've got to have a length that's sufficiently small, because we don't want to modify gravity at the centimeter scale, for example. But when I say large extra dimensions, what I really mean is large compared to the sort of standard particle physics, standard model scale. So, for example, if we took n equal 2, this wouldn't work because we would need a scale of about a millimeter. Although I suppose if we pushed our fundamental Planck scale up a bit, we could perhaps squeak around it. But for n equals 6, L is roughly 10 to the minus 12 millimeters. So that's completely safe from a direct detection, a direct gravitational experimental point of view. But of course, it's still large compared to particle interactions. So how can we have this situation? So we don't see the extra dimensions because we are confined to some submanifold, one of these brain worlds. So this is the sort of idea behind the large extra dimension scenario. So how can we be confined? I want to say a little bit about mechanisms for confinement or some toy models just to kind of try and motivate how you can get confinement. I mean, you know, again, if you're appealing to string theory, of course, you can always have confinement, because string theory has confined gauge theories on living on brains. But an interesting toy model that I think is always worth seeing based on the domain wall, and it was put forward by Rybakov and Shaposhnikov in the early 80s. So we have a domain wall type space-time, and we form it from a scalar field which has, the simplest example has a double well potential. And then our wall solution is like a kink, something which interpolates smoothly between each of the vacua, which has an energy that looks like sort of very strongly localized function. So the wall is localized on a scale given by the mass of the scalar particle. That's an example of, you know, how you get these walls in practice. But now I want to couple my scalar field to a spinner field, coupled to a fermion. So I'm really, I'm thinking quite, I'm looking really at a sort of, semi-classical or classical level here. So, I've got some coupling between my scalar and the fermion, but now if you think about what happens to the fermion in the background of this scalar field, most of the time the scalar is in one or the other of the vacua. So phi has an expectation value, and therefore this fermion has a mass. However, in the center of the wall, phi is zero, and so you have something that looks, locally at least, massless. So that's not, so it's not like you've got a uniform profile, a uniform behavior or nature for this Fermi field. And so maybe something, you know, you should think maybe something is going to happen in this non-trivial background. So let's look for a solution. So let's write our, you still got actually the five-dimensional gamma matrices are just the four-dimensional ones adding in the gamma five as your sort of fifth gamma matrix. So we can write our five-dimensional psi as something that looks like a four-dimensional spinner times a profile function in Z. And I'm going to choose a chiral spinner so that I gamma 5 times psi naught is equal to minus psi naught. So this gives me a nice ODE for this function psi. So what happens in the background of the wall, the lowest energy solution, you could have a solution psi being identically zero, but it turns out that the lowest energy solution for the field has this non-trivial profile. So in the background of that kink, the Fermi field kind of has this non-trivial profile. So this process is, in fact, known as condensation. This is the lowest energy solution. And then low energy excitations simply mean that you promote this psi naught into some space-time-dependent field. And so it's what you end up with is something that looks like a massless four-dimensional fermion. And so this is an example of confinement. It's a toy model just to illustrate how these some of these ideas, although they sound quite outlandish when you first meet them, how could we be confined to a submanifold? well, actually, this idea of confinement happens all the time, and you don't need to appeal to D-brains or whatever. You see it even if you just look at sort of normal field theory. If you have these backgrounds, these non-trivial profiles like the kink, some sort of vacuum defect, then you get, you know, this is the profile in the Z direction, which coincides with the core of the wall, and then you can have excitations kind of running sort of up and down along your domain wall. So from our perspective, living on the wall, we would just see this as a massless, normal field. So it, you know, it's a toy model, but at least it gives some, you know, some idea of why this might actually happen. So that's a sort of normal field. So what about gravity? So we talked a little bit about gravity in one of these brain world models. I introduced for you the Randall-Sundrum model, and then I think I ran out of time, so I sort of just quickly put up what were the low-energy gravitational equations. So I'll just try and say a bit more about that from a slightly different perspective. So in this Randall-Sundrum model, so I could do, so the Randall-Sundrum, let me just remind you, was where we had a domain wall in a five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. Sitting at z equals zero. And so our space-time has this very strong kind of peak. And we can look at what happens to gravity. We could look at it from the perspective of the Israel equations, or now that we've done perturbation theory, we could also do a gravitational perturbation theory. So we assume now that our eta mu nu goes to eta mu nu plus h. And then we could work through, we can compute our Lichnerowicz operator and then ask what the Green's function looks like. So I'll just write down what this gives us, although it's a bit of a long, bit of a mouthful. So the reason I went through the process of writing that down was in order to make just a couple of comments about things that often happen with higher dimensional gravity. So we're doing, this is taking a very different point of view of gravity, if you like. I'm thinking about looking at it more from a sort of almost like a particle physics point of view, perturbatively. And here I'm writing down what I get if I use that Lichnerowicz operator, but I have not gone in that Dodonda gauge. This is an example of a different gauge where I've used Gaussian normal. So I have to remember to keep those funny terms with the, you know, with the divergence of H bar. So you can see that, so the third equation are the mu nu Lichnerowicz components. The first two terms in that are the D'Alembertian. So you can see that there's the sort of normal space-time box, which I've written as partial squared. And the very first term is like the orthogonal part of that second derivative. And you can rewrite all the Christoffels, in, which are just derivatives of A. And then the extra pieces, you can see there's a term which is a divergence of the trace, you know, the H bar, as well as a trace term. So normally those would be zero in the Dodonda or transverse trace free gauge. The other two equations are like the mu z and the zz part of the Lichnerowicz. So notice that that last equation has a minus t on 3. So that is not the structure of an Einstein propagator, because that would be minus a half t. So so really, you would think initially, if you were doing this theory, that that might be a problem if you wanted to find out, you know, if you wanted to do linearized gravity, it's not going to have the right structure. But there's something that happens that is quite interesting with the, you know, in this particular theory. So I'll just take you, I can't really go through it in detail, but I'll try and give you some of the steps, because a lot of the ideas in this toy model come back when you do more complicated situations. So in order to find the linearized gravity field, so the first step is you construct the Green's function. So you do that by looking for homogeneous solutions. So you would set t equal to 0. So you find when you're looking at your solutions to this to the sort of homogeneous equation, you've got something that's like a zero mode, where it simply follows the profile. Your background solution follows that profile of the background warp factor, and then you get what you would identify with massive Kaluza-Klein modes. In other words, you've got solutions which have a non-trivial profile in the z direction. So you've got something that looks like e to the I p dot x times this profile in the z direction where p squared is m squared. So from a four-dimensional perspective, we're dealing with something that's massive, and the u is simply an eigenfunction in of the sort of transverse part of the wave operator there. Is there a minus sign somewhere? Sorry, tell me when to stop.
There.
Here.
Yes.
P squared?
And the next one.
Omega plus I epsilon?
Okay.
Squared? So P squared minus omega squared, if you like.
What is the lower limit?
Of this one. This one. Zero. So what you find is, so with normal Kaluza-Klein theory, you have a discrete spectrum of, you do a Fourier expansion. So sorry, K is that K that appears in the in the metric. Yeah. So K is the length as the inverse length scale. It's the anti de Sitter curvature. So the point about trying to find, you know, the sort of correct solutions to the Lichnerovich is that you have to. This here, if you do a coordinate transformation to that variable, just is a Bessel function, essentially. So it's got your two linearly independent solutions. And you find this particular combination by making sure that this derivative vanishes at the brain, because you need to satisfy your Israel junction conditions for each of these modes. So each of your Kaluza-Klein modes has to satisfy the right boundary conditions. So in a standard Kaluza-Klein theory, you have a discrete set of modes which are evenly spaced. And I think there's either a homework or a tutorial on this. Is it a homework, David? Mm-hmm. Looking at this. But the difference here is that we have, here we've got a continuum. Of massive modes going all the way down to m equals zero. So this is something quite different. And if I sketch what these things look like. So the zero mode simply tracks the warp factor. But a typical Kaluza-Klein mode might look something like this. Then it sort of starts wiggling very fast as you go along in Z. And so what you see is that the massless, the zero mode part of this is localized. But that these Kaluza-Klein states actually end up being relatively enhanced at larger values of Z. So it's kind of quite an interesting structure. But just to finish the story, that's the free theory. If we want to couple it to matter, we see that we can't necessarily let the trace of H be zero. So gauge transformations which preserve this Gaussian normal gauge can preserve this Gaussian normal gauge by, well, obviously we can do just four-dimensional gauge transformations, but this gauge transformation here is saying that our brain wobbles. So it's saying that Z goes to like Z plus F. So we can preserve our Gaussian normal gauge, but move the brain. And so that's what we have to do, in fact, to take account of matter. And we see that looking at our F equation there, we've got H mu mu then. Sorry?
What's B mu? Is it L mu?
Sorry, what's
the last term? What's that?
The last term is this one.
This? Zeta. I thought it's just meant to be a four-dimensional gauge transformation. So it's something that I'm not really interested in because it's kind of there anyway, or potentially there. So what I'm interested in is looking at what happens to this F term. And if I look at these second pieces, they're multiplied by A squared, so they don't show up in that Toplich-Nerovich equation. But from the sort of ZZ component of the Lichnerovich, you can see that the trace, this d squared f, couples to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. And so when I put both of these terms together and I sort of overall, then I see that by when I add this term to this term and look at what how I respond to the source, so it tells me that H so looking at it from this perspective, this term and this term add up to give precisely 4D Einstein gravity at the zero mode level. So what's happening here is that the brain responds to having matter on it by bending. So this here is some matter source. And so it kills off this sort of massive, or the wrong tensor structure, and you end up with Einstein gravity precisely on the brain.
Excuse me?
Yep.
When you're at ZM, what do you
mean? Zero mode, sorry. Time is running out, so I'm starting to abbreviate right, left, and center. So this is all I've done really with this is given bullet points, right? I haven't gone, and I freely admit I've not explained it in full detail. But what it's indicating is that when you have extra dimensions, although the original standard law from Kaluza-Klein theory was that they had to be curled up on an extremely small scale. You had to worry about stabilizing dangerous moduli. And, you know, in essence, the extra dimensions couldn't do anything for you. Once you allow yourself a brain world type of picture where you have confinement on a submanifold, you start to get all sorts of quite interesting gravitational phenomena. So here I've indicated a couple of them. You can generate a hierarchy between the sort of standard model scale and a gravitational, the Planck scale, by having large internal extra dimensions. Even though you might think gravity would be problematic, this particular toy model indicates maybe that's not the case, because here you have a completely well-defined theory of gravity, although that's more to do with an anti-de Sitter bulk. But also, some of these, although these are toy models, the features that I've described kind of transport over into more complicated situations. In particular, this idea of generating a large four-dimensional Planck scale by having or sizable, from a particle physics perspective, internal dimensions. Also, this notion of warping of internal dimensions, generating, again, an effective hierarchy. So if you kind of look here, you have one particular scale of gravity. But if you sort of move further over to larger Z, you can see that your gravitational force gets weaker. So again, this idea of having warped internal dimensions generating some disparity between a gravitational coupling and sort of normal gauge couplings, that is also something that persists. So, question?
So what are the candidates for correction terms to Einstein gravity?
So in this particular case, What you can do is if you put in, say, a delta function source to this H, so just like you normally do when you're doing linearized gravity in four dimensions, you find that you get the normal four-dimensional result, and then you have to do an integration here over the massive Kalitza-Klein mode. So there's a whole continuum integration. So the correction is coming from this. It's like got a 16 pi g, and then you're doing some integral over m of e to the minus mr over r times the zero value of these eigenfunctions. And so this comes to look like something like m over k. And so what you can then do is you can now do that integral over m. See, that just pulls down another factor of r. And so this is, I think it's only 2k actually. So you get 18 pi gk times 1 over k squared r squared. That's the form of it. I don't swear to exact constants, but that's the form of it. So whereas, of course, your Newtonian potential, this is like gn. And so your Newtonian potential would be sort of gn over r here. So it's... Hang on. Do I not get a 1 over r squared coming from that? So I think it should be 1 over k squared r squared is the correction term. So in this case, normally you expect sort of when you have corrections to gravity on the small scale, you might expect them to be exponential in type. But in this case, it's a power law. The reason it's a power law is that you have this continuum of Kalitza-Klein modes, which are all sort of superposing to give you these short-range corrections. So where to go from here? Well, in coming right back to the very first board, where people are trying to go from here is thinking about ways of, in some cases, using these extra degrees of freedom or the extra possibilities from having internal extra dimensions to modify gravity at very large scales. So there's some quite fun reading that you can do on modified gravity trying to get large-scale acceleration. And it's not too difficult to cook up these sort of brain world-type models to modify gravity at large scales, but they often tend to be plagued with inconsistencies. And, of course, in terms of modifying gravity to try and mock up dark matter, again, there's some interesting work that's been done on trying to make a sort of modified Newtonian dynamics relativistically consistent. I think the nail in the coffin of dark matter, though, is that there was an observation a couple of years back of what's called the Bullock cluster, where there's been two sort of galaxies that have obviously come very close or gone through each other in the cosmologically recent past. And there's very strong evidence that, in fact, if you look at where the actual contours of matter are versus where the luminous matter is, that it's really not some sort of... If you just had a modified gravity, you would expect the gravity to track the luminous matter. But here, there's evidence that there really is some additional dark matter that's just kind of passed through and gone its separate way. So I think things for dark matter in terms of trying to modify gravity don't look so convincing experimentally, but from the perspective of dark energy, there's still quite a lot of effort going into thinking about how to test whether you have Einstein gravity with some very, very small cosmological constant or whether there's some modification of gravity. And I think in the next sort of 10 years or so, better observations at sort of low redshift cosmologically, though high redshift astronomically, should help to pin down that issue. Anyway, I'm sure I'm running out of time. I have a feeling I'm going to get kicked out in a minute. So try to give you an overview of interesting problems in gravity. I've given you some tools. I've tried to go through some things in detail so that you can see how you actually do calculations and to sort of see gravity in action, as well as sort of trying to sort of pick out some topics that at least I find interesting. So it's been a fun class this year, and so thank you all, especially thanks to whoever it was that picked me up from the floor after I fell down skiing. So that's the end. Thank you.